42, if you will, please. We're going to retain that and sing at the close of our service tonight, because this happens to be my subject. I'll put Jesus first. The world all about me has now no allure. Its pleasures bring pain, its wisdom is vain. I seek a foundation that's steadfast and sure. I'll put Jesus first in my life. The Lord Jesus died my salvation to win. He went in my stead to Calvary and bled. Redemption impels me to give up all sin. I'll put Jesus first in my life. I know there's a home for the ransomed and blessed when death is no more, when struggle is o'er. For those who love Jesus and give him their best, I'll put Jesus first in my life. The worst tribulations continue each day. Though pleasures may call, though evil enthrall, his grace will protect me forever and a. I'll put Jesus first in my life. In all that I say, in all that I do, throughout the world of toil and strife, by day and by night, through trust in his might, I'll put Jesus first in my life. You'll see that the music to this song, as well as the words, were written by James D. Forrest Murch. James D. Forrest Murch was a good friend of Nell and myself. He's been in our home on numerous occasions, and I have been with him in conventions many times, sitting on the same platform and speaking in the same meeting. Time after time again, as we were sitting in hotel rooms or motels far remote from our own homes, James D. Forrest Murch told me the story of how this song came to be written. And just 6 days before he departed this life, his book, his biography, autobiography, Adventuring for Christ in Times of Change, came from the press. And he had time before he died to inscribe one of these books and to autograph it and to send it to Nell and myself. Tonight, I want to say to you that James D. Forrest Murch was no common man. He was the man who, when he lived in Washington, D.C., was the managing editor of Christianity Today, one of the greatest religious journals in our generation. He was the man who conceived the idea of the presidential prayer breakfast, and who persuaded the president in that day to call together all the senators, all the congressmen, to bring them together and to pray to God, and to get upon their knees and to invoke the blessings of God, a practice that has been carried on ever since. And James D. Forrest Murch was always a welcome guest at the presidential breakfast and never missed. But at the time when this song was written, he'd gone through a peculiar period of deep depression. As a matter of fact, he was sitting one day in his library, wondering, you know, what was wrong with his life. He felt that he was empty and vacuous, in spite of the fact he was going all the time and speaking all the time, and he never missed a meeting in the church. There was something wrong and something sadly wrong. And all of a sudden, sitting there at the desk, he put his hand up over his face and buried his face in his hand and said, "Oh God, I'm empty. For some reason, I need help." He always said that he heard a voice speak to him. He said that as this voice spoke to him, all of a sudden, he had imprinted upon his mind in burning, living letters of shining gold the words of a certain passage in Romans chapter 12. "And be not conformed to this world, but be you transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God." Now, I want you to listen to a statement that I'm going to read directly from his own hand as written in the book, Adventuring for Christ in Changing Times. "We who have allowed our material heritages and environments to bind, gag, and deliver us to the world, the flesh, and the devil, need to know the joy of release, which can only come through Jesus Christ. To make a long story short, with tears that came from the depth of my soul, I made the surrender. It wrenched and ground and devastated me. I know now that I was being recreated, made over into a different person. I had opened my life to God in a way I had never done before, and he had come in. I was conscious of a presence within me, and descending upon me a kind of cleansing, flushing force throughout my mind and active consciousness, much as a fireman's hose would flush out a clogged tile. Then, with sterilizing effect, it seemed that my entire being was purified as a laboratory technician cleanses his instruments or a surgeon cauterizes a wound. And this was followed with a feeling that my whole self was being flooded with light, glorious, golden, luminous. And the voice said, I have forgiven thee and redeemed thee. Henceforth, you are not your own. You are mine. I claim you for my witness. From that day in the library, my life has been showered with riches and blessings far greater than I have ever dared to think. Out of this experience came my song, I'll Put Jesus First in My Life. The words and music came to me in bed one morning at about 3 o'clock. I am no musician, so I call it the song the Lord gave me. The Lord has used this song in a marvelous way in bringing thousands of decisions for Christ, decisions for restoration and renewal, and decisions for full-time Christian service. It appears in countless hymnals and has been translated into many languages. The chorus is a favorite in revival meetings, camp meetings, and summer conferences. I shall never forget one time when we were on a university campus and there must have been some 6,000 people crowded into the auditorium to hear Mr. Murch speak first and then to hear me finish with my address that day. And when they introduced him, as if it were by a prearranged signal, it may have been, these 6,000 young people stood up and they sang the first verse of, I'll Put Jesus First in My Life. The world all about me has now no allure. Its pleasures bring pain. Its wisdom is vain. I seek a foundation that steadfast and sure, I'll put Jesus first in my life. 6,000 fresh young voices of brilliant and perceptive young college people standing up and singing as a tribute to this man. You see, when you accept Jesus, really accept Jesus, when you surrender your life to Jesus, it's going to make a difference. It isn't a matter of just bearing intellectual testimony to the fact that you believe that Jesus lived 19 centuries ago, that he walked through the dusty roads of Judea, or that he even hanged upon the cross, as we discussed this morning. But it's a matter of letting Jesus so change and transform your life that you can never be the same kind of a personality before. When Jesus confronts a person, he confronts him with a challenge. I want you to listen to one of those challenges in the words of Jesus himself. It was recorded by a young man called Mark in 9:34 and 35. Then he called his disciples and the crowds to come over and listen. If any of you wants to be my follower, he told them, you must put aside your own pleasure and shoulder your cross and follow me closely. If you insist on saving your life, you will lose it. Only those who throw away their lives for my sake and for the sake of the good news will ever know what it really means to live. Do you believe that? If you believe that, it's going to make a change in your life. Only those who throw away their lives for my sake and for the sake of the good news will ever know what it really means to live. Listen to another challenge from Jesus, this time recorded by a tax collector, a member of the Federal Reserve and the Internal Revenue Commission of that day, a man by the name of Matthew, in 6:31-34. So don't worry at all about having enough food and clothing. Why be like the heathen? For they take pride in all these things and are deeply concerned about them. But your heavenly Father already knows perfectly well that you need them, and he will give them to you if you give him first place in your life and live as he wants you to. So don't be anxious about tomorrow. God will take care of your tomorrow too. Live one day at a time. Now, did you get what Jesus said? Jesus said he will give them to you if you will give him first place in your life, as he wants, and live as he wants you to. Listen to another challenge, this time again from Matthew. All who listen to my instructions and follow them are wise, like a man who builds his house on solid rock. Though the rain comes in torrents, and the floods rise, and the storm winds beat against this house, it won't collapse, for it is built upon a rock. Listen again while Matthew puts it in these words in 10:37 and 38 of his blessed book. I've been reading Matthew lately, and I hope you'll pardon me if I talk a lot about what Matthew recorded about what Jesus said. If you love your father and mother, More than you love me, you're not worthy of being mine. Or if you love your son or daughter more than me, you're not worthy of being mine. If you refuse to take up your cross and follow me, you are not worthy of being mine. Just Friday night of this week, night before last, I went to Washington University. There, I sat with two of my grandchildren in an audience, and I talked to a number of young people. Two of them were atheists and agnostics. They questioned me at the completion of my speech. As we came down from the building and we were walking over to the car, my grandson, my oldest grandson, said to me, "Granddad, that was great. That was terrific. And I want you to know that I'm really glad you asked me to come and go with you." Well, tears came to my eyes when I thought that here was my grandson home from university where he's attending, and he said to me, "Granddad, that was wonderful, and I appreciate you asking me to go." And when we got in the car, all of a sudden it happened that I thought that tonight I'm going to be speaking on "I'll Put Jesus First." And I looked at him there in the dark, and I thought to myself, would I be willing to put Jesus ahead of this boy whom I love so much? Every Monday morning, I write to all my grandchildren that are in university. Every Monday morning, I send them a letter. I tell them what happened on Sunday. I exhort them to be faithful. I try to plead with them to live for him and to keep alive the witness and testimony in their lives. And as I sat there and thought about this man whom I love so much, who's literally bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, I thought, if I had to do it, would I love Jesus more than I love Griffin? Jesus put it this way: anyone who gives up his home, brothers, sisters, father, mother, wife, children, or property to follow me shall receive 100 times as much in return and shall have eternal life. But many who are first now will be last then, and some who are last now will be first then. Matthew chapter 19, verses 29 and 30. Now Abraham had to meet the text. God said to Abraham, "Abraham, I want you to take your son, your only beloved son, and I want you to go to the mountain of Moriah, and I want you to offer him as a sacrifice for me." Now, all my life, I've wondered, you know, how a man could have the faith that Abraham had. The record says, "And Abraham arose very early in the morning before it was light." Oh, I would have put that off as long as I could put it off. But Abraham arose early in the morning, and the record says, and he took the wood, and he took the fire, and he took a knife, and he took his son Isaac, and they started out. And as they were going along, Isaac said, "Father, here's the wood, and here's the knife, and here's the fire, but where is the sacrifice?" And Abraham said, "Son, God will provide the sacrifice." And he took that boy up on top of Mount Moriah, and he said, "God, you taught me, and you told me when I had faith and went out and looked at the stars and couldn't count them, and looked at the sands of the seashore and didn't know how many there were. You told me then that Sarah was going to bear me a son, and that his name should be called Isaac, and through him the world would be blessed. And now, God, you want me to give him back to you? You want me to take his life?" But you know, in the New Testament, the record says that Abraham was willing to do that because he accounted that God was able to raise him from the dead, which he did in a figure. Now that's faith. Abraham had to meet the test, and he didn't fail it. The young, rich young ruler who came to Jesus was put to the test, and he flunked the test. He failed it. You remember what happened upon the occasion as he came and said, "Now, good master, what do I have to do to have eternal life?" And Jesus said to this rich young ruler, because he saw he was very rich and he trusted in his riches, he said to him, "You go and sell all that you have and give to the poor." And the record says he went away very sorrowful because he had great riches. He looked at Jesus and he looked at his money in the building and loan association, and he looked at his money in the bank in Jerusalem. And when he thought about the money and he thought about his building and loan stock and he thought about Jesus, he went away very sorrowful, and he kept his building and loan stock, and he kept his investment in the bank, and he kept his business. He just simply couldn't make the choice. Abraham passed the test. The rich young ruler failed it. Now, you know, there's a big problem that we face in these days, and I want to tell you what I think that problem is. We were talking about it in the high school class this morning. When we read the Bible, we read it as if it were written to people 19 centuries ago, and we can't see how it will fit into this world in which we live. When Jesus lived on earth, he either had to walk or ride a donkey. Now we can get on a jet plane, and in 3 1/4 hours, I can land at International in Los Angeles. In a matter of 1 hour and 45 minutes, I can step off at LaGuardia in New York, and have often done so. Now how can you take this simple challenge of Jesus 19 centuries ago and put it into focus in our lives today? I want to tell you about 3 people that I've met within the past year and a half. I think 18 months would catch it. I want to tell you about 3 people that did it. I want you to know that it really works today. I want you to know the solution that they found. I was in the East in the state of Ohio, and I spoke to a group of college young people one day and answered their questions. The entire football team was there, and their coach was there, and I spoke to them about Jesus and about my convictions, and I answered their questions. And when I got through, a young man came to me and he said, "Sir, I hope that I'm not being too forward, but I'd like to talk with you. I've got to talk to an older man. I've got to talk to somebody I think will understand, and I think you'll understand." I said to him, "All right, I'll be glad to give you an hour of my time. Where shall we talk?" He said, "Could you come over to a corner of Student Union, and we'll get back there in one of the nooks of Student Union, and I want to talk to you." And then he told me, he said, "You know, I'll never forget the morning, Mr. Ketcherside, when I got ready to come to this university." He said it was kind of a sad time. That morning at breakfast when we came in, my mother was crying, wiping away the tears from her eyes. She didn't want me to go away to college. She was afraid. But he said she had a package wrapped up there by her plate, and when my dad and my mom bowed their heads to return thanks, my mother prayed for me that morning, and I listened to her pray for me. And he said she gave me this package, and she said to me, "Son, here's a copy of the Living Bible, and I've marked it in places that I want you to especially remember." And she said, "If you ever get in trouble, I want you to turn and read that." He said to me, "Mr. Ketcherside, I've been a Christian ever since I was a boy, and I came away to this school resolved that I'd not fall for the traps of Satan, that I'd keep myself clean." But he said, "I was living in the dorm, and there was another kid who was living there with me, and he said he had no commitment to Christ whatsoever. And he introduced me to another boy who was a friend of his, and he said one night they talked me into going over to a house just off campus that was maintained by 2 girls and a former married woman who was only 20 years of age but had left her husband. And these fellows," he said, "these boys said to me, 'Come on, you'll have a good time. You'll have a better time than you've ever had in your life. You come with us and you'll learn things you've never learned before.' And he said, 'I didn't want to go, and yet I did want to go. I wanted to go because I knew how I would be laughed at and ridiculed as a panty waste if I didn't go. And so,' he said, "finally I gave in, and even against my inner judgment and conviction, I said, 'Okay, I'll go.' And he said, when I got there that night, we didn't get there until it was almost 10 o'clock. And he said, when we got there that night, the first thing they did was to bring out a couple of bottles of wine. And he said, I'd never taken anything intoxicating in my life, but they kept pouring the wine, and they kept making fun of it, and the girls kept drinking it. And he said, when they paired off, they put me with this 20-year-old girl who had been married and had left her husband and was maintaining this house there and seemingly gratifying her ego by seeing how many boys she could seduce. And he said, that night, I committed fornication for the first time in my life." And he started to cry. Well, I waited till he got through brushing away the tears, and he said, "I left there before daylight the next morning, we all did." And he said, "All day long I was in a fog, Mr. Ketcherside. I was in a dream." He said, "I didn't know a thing that went on in these classes. And I went back to my room that night." And he said, "My roommate was gone. He was somewhere else." And he said, "I was there." And he said, "I got up and vomited. And my body felt so unclean that I got up and took 2 showers and tried to clean myself. And I found out that soap wouldn't clean me." And he said, "At 4 o'clock in the morning, I hadn't slept a wink. And I got up." And he said, "I went over and I got this book." And he said, "I want to tell you the first thing I read. My mother said, 'Son, I've marked this for you.' And he said, just by chance, I turned over, and I want to tell you where I read." And he told me, and this is what it said: 'Only wisdom from the Lord can save a man from the flattery of prostitutes. These girls have abandoned their husbands and flouted the laws of God. Their houses lie along the road to death and hell. The men who enter them are doomed. None of these men will ever be the same again. Follow the steps of the godly instead and stay on the right path. For only good men enjoy life to the full. Evil men lose the good things they might have had, and they themselves shall be destroyed. And he said, then I looked up at the chapter above that. He said, you know, that's in Proverbs 1, 16 and 20. And then he said, I looked over and I found this. My son, never forget the things I've taught you. He said, my mother had marked that with red. She put a red mark along the side. My son, never forget the things I've taught you. If you want a long, satisfying life, follow closely my instructions. Never forget to be truthful and kind. Hold these virtues tightly. Write them deep within your heart. If you want favor with God and man and a reputation for good judgment and common sense, then trust the Lord completely. Don't ever trust yourself. In everything you do, put God first, and He will direct you and crown your efforts with success. And he said, Mr. Ketcherside, I got down there on my hands and knees, and that wasn't enough. He said, I prostrated myself on that rug, and I lay full length, and I said, oh, God, please forgive me. God, please clean me. Please make me like I used to be before, Lord. I'm going to put you first in my life. Nothing else will ever count. Nothing but you. And he said, all of a sudden, I felt clean again and forgiven. And I knew the power of God. He said, is this what happens when you really come to God and put Jesus first in your life? It was only a matter of a few months after that. I was in a meeting in the West, and they asked me if I'd rather stay in a motel or rather stay with a family. And I said, well, I'd rather stay with a family. So they put me with a family that was one of the finest families I'd ever been with. There was a man and his wife, and they had two little children. I think they were about probably maybe 13 and 11 or something like that. And I came to love them very much. I had never seen a couple that got along any better than they did. And one morning at the breakfast table, I said, you know, I want to tell you how richly I feel God blessed me to bring you into my life and to let me stay in your home instead of sleeping over there in a motel by myself at night. And I want to tell you how much it means to me to be with a real Christian family. And he looked at her, and she looked at him, and he said, shall I tell him? And she said, well, why don't you start? He said, Carl, it's a thrill to us to have you here. But he said, do you realize we almost broke up? When we got married, I wasn't a Christian, he said. And when we were courting, and I asked her to marry me, she said, well, I want you to know that I'm a Christian. And I wish you were. I'd give anything in the world if you were. But she said to him, Jim, I love you so much, and I love you so dearly, and I love you with all my being, and I'm going to marry you, but I want you to promise me to go to church with me every Sunday. I've got to have help to live the Christian life. Well, he said it didn't mean anything to me. You know, I wanted her. I wanted her to live with me, and I wanted her. And he said, I said, why, sure, heavens, yes, that's no problem. I'll always go to church with you. And then he looked at her and she took it up. And she said, Carl, he went with me for about 7 months. And then he began to stay in bed. And he began to grumble. And he began to say, well, if you want to go to church, you go on. But I work hard all week, and this is the only day I've got to catch up on my sleep. And I'm going to stay here. And he said, she said, I'd get up and go in the bathroom, and I'd fix myself and dress and go to meeting and leave Jim lying there in bed. And always when I went to meeting, I'd say a prayer for him, but it didn't seem to get any place. And then he took it up again. He said, Carl, you know I got so jealous of Jesus, I said to myself, what in the name of sense do I have to play second fiddle to a man that lived on earth 19 centuries ago, that my wife thinks more of him and loves him more than she does me, and she's married to me. And he said, one day I came in to her, and I said to her, I think you and I are at the crossroads, and you may have to choose between me and Jesus. And I said, she looked at me, and she said, Jim, come over and sit beside me on the divan. And I went over and sat beside her, and said, she looked me in the eye, and she took my hand, and she said, Jim, I hope it would never come to the place where I'd have to make a choice between you and Jesus, because I love you so much. But I want you to know that if I do, That choice was made 19 centuries ago, and it wasn't made by me, it was made by Jesus. And Jesus is the only one in this world that I love more than I do you, Jim. You can have my body, I belong to you, and I love you, and I want you, but I want you to know that Jesus has my life. And that decision is not mine to make, it was made on a cross 19 centuries ago. He said, I fought that for about 4 more months, and I said, well, if I'm ever really going to be happy with her, I'm going to have to get with Jesus. And he said, you know, the minute I surrendered to Jesus, I began to be happier than I'd ever been before. And he said, now, you know, it's a real thrill. Here we've got these children. Both of them have been baptized. Both of them are in Christ. And Carl, the kind of a family you see today, was made because my wife put Jesus first in her life, even ahead of me. Well, one more to show you that it really works. I know an old sister, a real elderly sister. She's a widow, and she has to live alone. She lives inside of a little apartment, inside of 4 walls. And I went to see her and to pray with her, and I said, how are you getting along? And she said, Carl, I'm frightfully lonely. I didn't think the time would ever come when I would be as frightened and scared and lonely as I am. But she said the other night, I found the answer. And I said, what was the answer? And she said, well, I couldn't sleep, and I got up at 1 o'clock in the morning, and I went in and turned the light on, and I began to read. And she said, I read this, and I marked it because I want you to listen to it. And she took her Bible and read this. Friendship with God is reserved for those who reverence Him. With them alone He shares the secret of His presence. My eyes are ever looking to the Lord for help, for He alone can rescue me. Come, Lord, and show me Your mercy, for I am helpless, overwhelmed, in deep distress. My problems go from bad to worse. Oh, save me from them all. See my sorrows, heal my pain, forgive my sins. And she said, you know what a sinner reference is? And I said, yeah. And she said, well, there was a reference over to the New Testament. And I turned over and read this in Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. For God has said, I will never, never fail you nor forsake you. That is why we can say without any doubt or fear, the Lord is my helper, and I'm not afraid of anything that mere man can do unto me. And she said, Carl, since that morning at 1:30 when I read this and got down on my knees and said, God, I'll never be afraid again. I haven't had one moment's fear, and I've never known the joy that I've had. I still have the loneliness for my husband because we lived together so many years. We slept together and ate together. And I have the loneliness for him, but I've learned that I don't have to be afraid, that if I'll put Jesus first in my life, that he'll come in and fill it. Here are 3 people that during the last 18 months have demonstrated the truth of the song that was written by James B. Forrest Murray at 3 o'clock one morning, the song that the Lord gave you. I hope you'll sing it with us as we stand and sing number 104.